Thank you, Maggie. Welcome, John and Mark, and all
Thank
those
you.
Joining in. So I, Mark has changed my mind. The only way I can introduce him is that he's a traditional economist, studied economics, and he's kind of opened the world to me. That it's one thing to complain about the economy and see what's wrong with it, and that's pretty easy to read about. You see it on the headlines every day. But he's really inverted our thinking about it and said that the measures we're using are wrong, that happiness is a possibility in the world, and we see that becoming popular. And so he also invited me to a conference of economists. And for 2 days, I was just dazzled with people telling me things I just didn't know. I didn't know there was a state bank in North Dakota that kept that state because it was a public institution from the highs and lows of the economic range. And I didn't know that the national debt is mostly interest that we pay to the private sector. And it was just amazing generosity, Mark. And I thank you for inviting me there. And thank you for the work. Mark and I have become friends. And he's a teacher of mine. So, Mark, I just first like to just welcome you and thank you for being here and what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Peter and John.
So I thought as an opening, just for orientation, we hear a lot about the new economy. Could you just give us a headline and why now you think this is becoming such a subject of public conversation?
Well, I think the so-called new economy is, I believe, so important today because we're on the verge of many significant shifts in the world system. We have climate change. We're on the verge, I believe, of a significant debt crisis that will, I believe, soon be upon us, even worse than 2008. And we're the questions of why do we continue to measure progress using things like the gross domestic product since World War II? Why do we continue to have a debt finance system? Are even more pressing issues today. And we have an obligation, I believe, to reestablish a deeper understanding of the word economy, which means household stewardship, to find new solutions to our intractable debt crisis. I call it a form of debt slavery. And to free us from that would mean to orient our economy to what I'm calling an economy of well-being. I know you and others are talking about economics of compassion. But that economy of well-being can be properly and effectively navigated if we reestablish the sort of foundations of which capitalism should be built on, which is this notion of what I call genuine wealth and wealth. The word meaning the conditions of well-being from the Old English, the word happiness meaning spiritual well-being from the Greek. So I believe we can reestablish a new economy based on these new fundamental principles that well-being becomes the penultimate bottom line and objective and best interest of all societies.
So I think if you could just say a little more about when you say the word well-being, what goes through your mind? Can you make that more concrete for us?
Well-being in the work I'm doing with First Nations people, Aboriginal people, constitutes spiritual, mental, physical, emotional well-being. We've had others, of course, from Aristotle onwards, Maslow, people like Max Neef talk about what are the kind of foundational contributions to a happier life, well-being. And it begins with sufficiency of material needs, which is what Thomas Aquinas wrote about a long time ago, building on Aristotle, followed by good health, mental, physical, emotional health, relationships, which is the fundamental building block of happy communities, something we can affect. And finally, self-actualization or happiness. These are what I would call the building blocks of well-being, all bounded by a healthy natural environment. Healthy ecosystems are fundamental to thriving, flourishing communities.
Well, what seems stunning to me is that you're taking questions of happiness and spiritual, physical well-being and including them in the domain of economics. Like you said, the original meaning was household management. But you're saying this is an economic, these are economics questions that the economy ought to deal with rather than either spiritual questions or health questions or lifestyle questions. Who's interested in this? Who's your audience for this kind of thinking?
Well, I seem to have a very broad audience. From last week, I met with the Minister of Health Policy, Chief Medical Officer, here in Alberta, and there's the whole theme of Alberta Health today is wellness. And so they asked me, well, how are you measuring wellness? And I said, well, we're doing exciting things with people like Peter Block and John McKnight and Howard Lawrence by going into communities, neighborhoods, talking to our neighbors about what brings their life meaning, what are their gifts and skills, asking them their subjective opinions about their expectations of well-being for themselves, for their work, for their children, and then marrying that with objective metrics that we collect regularly anyways. We collect all kinds of socioeconomic statistics and health statistics, so we need to marry the experiential information, the self-ratings of well-being and the objective data, and then begin to understand both the household level, but the neighborhood level, at the community and the civic municipal level. What does well-being look like? How is it distributed? Is there inequity in well-being conditions? And then what do we do about it with respect to policies and budgets and capital operating budgets? And those are the things. So I'm getting good resonance. Those people, city managers, who understand that this is a new frontier, this whole well-being-based budgeting is a new frontier. It's not going to be easy, but it's I think it's an opportunity worth exploring in a serious way.
Mark, this is John. I'm wondering if you could help us by being as specific as possible for a couple of examples. If you're interested in objective metrics and you're focusing on broadly the question of happiness and well-being, can you describe what you actually are measuring, you're quantifying within that framework?
Absolutely. So within the framework I've developed called Genuine Wealth, there are five asset classes or domains. I have an accounting background, so forgive me for bringing back balance sheet conversation. But, you know, the whole basis of accounting is measuring what matters, which is, so what are the assets of a community? So in tangible terms, on the human asset side, what are our skills, our aspirations, or even our spiritual well-being? We can measure those. We develop survey tools to do so. On the social capital front, we talk about belonging, measuring subjective perceptions of trust, of each other, of businesses, of government, because trust is the most precious of all assets, in my opinion, and goes undervalued in conventional balance sheets. We call it goodwill, but we undervalue goodwill. On the natural capital side, we measure the quality of land, water, wetlands, ecological services. We put monetary values on those. And then built capital is infrastructure, financial, of course, money, debt, and then my favorite word, equity, which is distribution of well-being. And all of this can be put into so once we've established these accounts, we've established basically a well-being assessment, a checkup, an inventory, we can generate indicators. You know, there's many different ones. There's Canadian Index of Well-Being that we've developed over the last 10 years in Canada, or the Genuine Progress Indicator, which is an adjustment to GDP for the full cost of social and environmental degradation. So we begin to formalize this accounting system by reestablishing a community balance sheet that shows the assets, the liabilities, the equity. a proper income statement, which shows not just GDP, but what's actually driving GDP and what's actually degrading, what's depreciation on our human and social capital. And all of these things are, they're tangible examples. You can find on my corporate website, work I've been doing over the years with the city of Edmonton, showing the chief economist how to budget based on a well-being index and connect taxes. Imagine connecting a change in taxes to the change in the well-being index of Edmonton. And that, those are things that we're pursuing. And now with Howard down to the neighborhood level, to the really granular level of living.
When you say one thing that you're interested in measuring is social capital, a lot of our work in the ABCD world is focused there, and that there you can focus on belonging and trust. Can you describe how you measure that? I mean, what is it that you're trying to quantify as an indicator of increased social capital, belonging, and trust? Can you give us examples?
Well, for the municipal level, we've developed a survey tool that, again, is grounded in Maslow's, wealth, health, relationship, and happiness. And we ask people to rate their own expectations of belonging, their sense of alienation, perhaps because of race, gender, sex. Mm. We ask them to rate their levels of trust of neighbors, family, businesses, workplace, and we get some really interesting results, because we're not just asking opinions, we're asking what is your personal, your own expectations, and do you feel you're meeting those expectations? So what we get is a really robust just breakdown of levels of expectations, and we would say even thresholds of what we think people are living below expectation, below what we think people should be living at. And we can show that across zip codes, postal codes, age, sex, whatever.
Right.
And that's pretty exciting. And so that's what I mean at the community level. In the corporate setting, we're helping companies understand that, most corporations today, their most important asset are relational assets, intangibles, trust, right? Even workplace happiness. And can we quantify that? Absolutely. We can go and ask clients, what's your relationship with this firm, with Coca-Cola or whoever it is? What's the level of trust? And you know what? That subjective rating translates into your financials. And can you book trust as an asset? I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I point to Coca-Cola, say, their brand, 28% of their balance sheet is intangible, including their brand. That's why Warren Buffett likes Coca-Cola, right? He knows that this company, whether you like Coke or not, is counting for its intangibles in a wise way. So.
Mark, if you were thinking about your measures then of social capital, do you have a way of keeping, of doing that through time? That is, what would tell us the most would be not where we are now, but what kinds of changes are taking place, and then some ability to try to see what are the determinants of those changes. And I'm just wondering whether you've got that structured like in Edmonton or someplace.
I think our proposal to municipalities, and I have to say that, we haven't got the traction we'd like yet. So we're just planting seeds at this stage, and thank you for your work and Howard's pioneering. But the proposal, for example, the City of Edmonton is, married to what Howard's doing on the measuring, the assets in the community, would be an ongoing live well-being survey that would be live all the time. And people would be self-rating their well-being. Gallup is measuring happiness of Americans every day. 1,000 Americans get polled every day. And so what's stopping us from thinking about an app that says, have you filled out your well-being? How happy are you in your neighborhood? And would be a fun way of boy, city council would be enlivened, I can tell you, if councilors were comparing their ward's well-being indices based on real input, dynamic, longitudinal. And the other proposals were, that's one proposal. The second is to introduce a well-being census instrument. So every 2 years when the population census is done, you get some of those households who participate with Howard voluntarily to say, will you fill out a longer well-being census form to give us some objective statistics so we can now compare your subjective ratings with your household income, your age. We can even track you through time. And maybe we incentivize them, give them a little cut on their taxes or, gift certificate or local restaurant or whatever. But I think we can incentivize this. And I think cities need to, can get into this game of well-being census and finance probably for less than a Starbucks latte, per capita to keep this whole thing working. That's what we're proposing.
Ah.
That's so thoughtful. Do you want to have another question, John? Or do it?
Want to interrupt? Yeah, I'm just wondering now as you're setting up this method of measurement, and it's very creative, it's telling us mostly about the experience and the sense of well-being plus some more specific things. I'm wondering then, if you have this information, what are the policy possibilities that would grow from that? It is I now am in Edmonton, and it's 4 years out, and I've had two censuses, and I have I can see some shifts in these measures. The question then might be, I'm the mayor, or city manager in terms of local government or even at the provincial level, what do you see as the policy options that might grow from what you learn?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll speak from my experience in the area of performance measurement and policy in the Alberta government in the finance ministry. So we oversaw the whole performance measurement system for Alberta. And that was in the mid-1990s. So this is where a lot of these ideas come from, that experience of saying, okay, if we were to use this information to, first of all, the theme is measuring what matters to well-being. So the question, are we measuring what matters? Is the chief economist measuring what matters? Does the CFO have a balance sheet for the city? I could tell you all public accounts do not have a formal balance sheet. It's unbelievable to think that, as I say, Warren Buffett would be upset if Coca-Cola didn't have a balance sheet. So what we want to do here is establish a genuine balance sheet for the community's assets. And that should guide budgeting, capital, and operating decision-making. It will guide community services in terms of, well, which neighborhoods are flourishing objectively, not subjectively, and why. Now we get curious about, can we begin to invest in improving well-being conditions and ensuring the distribution of well-being is more evenly distributed across neighborhoods. Can we demonstrate a well-being ROI on policies and programs? Absolutely. In fact, it's incumbent on us as public, officials to do so. Now, politicians would love to know and demonstrate to citizens that, yes, your taxes are going up 3%, but the Edmonton Well-Being Index went up 2% last year. So, and I've shown this to the city council saying, look, your index is going up. Yes, taxes are going up too. Now, I'm not saying there's a direct correlation there, but, this is good news for any politician. So these are the practical applications of the work. Now, I'd go as far as saying at the neighborhood design level, when we're designing neighborhoods, we know that the most vibrant neighborhood in Edmonton is my community, Strathcona. Why? Because people say it's walkable. And Ironically, it's part of Edmonton that stopped growing in 1913 because it was amalgamated in the city of Edmonton, and the buildings now are sterilized in history, but they've become an asset, become the most walkable, desirable place to live. So I'm curious, as an architect, can we think about well-being by design? You know, what makes for the highest walk score communities? And can we attach to walk score well-being, subjective well-being indicators that go, wow, now the real estate industry is like, you should live in this neighborhood because they have the best walk score and they have the best subjective self-rated well-being index, right?
You're also measuring neighborliness. You know, I think people now, the new urbanism, talk about, you know, mixed use and walkability, but you're going deeper than that. You're talking about people's relationship with each other, their trust in each other. And it may be that some of the most beautiful physical neighborhoods, the people's relationship, they might be surprised at what their life, you know, happiness is really like.
That's right, yeah. So I come from this from a very nerdy accountability. I love accountability. I know it sounds weird. I'm like, you know, we are stewards of God's creation. So, damn it, we have a responsibility to be accountable for the funds we expend and the effort, you know, we put into life. And I think we can do this. I don't think it's beyond the realm of, this is the new economy.
What about, as an individual, you mentioned the term debt slavery. Could you describe what you mean by that and how your thinking of this economy might come to terms or shift that in some way?
So most people, it's happening in England right now. Not since 1844 has there been a conversation in the British Parliament about the nature of money. What these parliamentarians have realized, like I did many years ago, is that I always thought that the government creates the money on behalf of the people, and the banks just serve as sort of, you know, financial intermediaries. But the truth is 98% of our money supply is created in the form of debt when banks issue loans, 98%. The U.S. right now has $60 trillion in debt. Since World War II, debt doubles every 7 years. Isn't that amazing? Now, the Jews said, forgive debts every 7 years. So the fact that in 7 years' time, the U.S. debt will probably hit $120 million, it is now consuming the $60 trillion, is taking about 35 cents of every dollar Americans earn or spend is now interest payments on the collective debt, because there's debt embedded in everything. So most of us have no idea. We are debt slaves, and that is true globally. Now, the challenge is, what do you do about it? I don't know. I mean, it'll either collapse, because right now the interest payments in the national debt in the U.S. exceed the military budget. And that is not an official number because they use funny words like net interest. I said, no, I want a gross interest calculation for the U.S. people. For Canadians. And so think about it, a third of our lives, our working lives, will be spent paying for interest on debts which are completely unnecessary if we actually adopted Ben Franklin and Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Jackson's ideas, which is that, you know, the government creates the money for the people without cost, without usury, without mortgages, which in French means a death pledge. So that's my tough love message. Now, can we move towards a debt-free system? Absolutely. That's why I was in London, England, the House of Lords. I said, we can do this. It'll take an act of courage, but the problem is there's just systemic ignorance. And if the House of Parliament in London is only understanding this and has never debated it since 1844, imagine that debate happening in Washington. Wow. Imagine that.
Fascinating. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I just wondered, can you weave the idea of savings into this question of debt? Do you look at savings positively? The whole notion of... decreasing your consumption and increasing your savings? Is that something that fits in this framework?
It's part of a circular problem. Although I would say absolutely, I would say anyone listening, get out of debt if you can. Do not incur more debt, please. I mean, we're already debt slaves. Savings is just a game to invest. So we invest our after-tax, right, usury money in accounts which generate interest, right? And if the richer we are, of course, the more, you know, financial assets we have, which actually inflates our neighbor because we're getting 3% or 2%, whatever, from our neighbor, right? So the whole system is a systemic system of usury. So, yes, savings is great, you know, in terms of if it teaches you anything about good financial management and not incurring ridiculous levels of debt, which are unsustainable anyways. Of course, I would love to just reboot the whole computer, start again. But unfortunately, I think it's only going to come upon us by catastrophe, and not by a courageous act of government to restructure the world financial system, which actually needs to happen desperately. So, but I'm not convinced that that's going to happen. So savings, great, but understand it's all part of a system of interest-based money. There's one caller was asked about a guaranteed income. Now, what I would do under a genuine wealth model is, which is what Abraham Lincoln said, is that if you think about it, if the creation of money can be done by governments without cost, why wouldn't we institute a living wage ordinance which would ensure that nobody goes to sleep at night, no senior citizen, anxious about tomorrow, because they at least have a floor, they have $15 an hour to live off of. Now, it doesn't stifle innovation. I'm not accusing of being communist here, whatever that means, but to in the sense that, look, we can create enough money to finance our economy to be the best, most flourishing economy possible. You can adjust the cash flow liquidity very finely on a daily basis, leave enough for innovation, entrepreneurship, but make sure that no American or Canadian goes to sleep at night anxious about tomorrow. And most of our conflicts is about money anyways. And that's my vision. And that's possible. I know it's possible.
What would this mean? Say more as an individual. How might I change? I mean, first thing you said, get out of debt. I assume then you think I should not have a house mortgage.
Oh, no. And it's impossible not to have an education without debt or a house mortgage, right? That's the reality. So at the individual level, you know, I think, first of all, we need better financial literacy. I mean, the fact that very few people even know about the money system just means, wow, you and I know when we talk to young people in their 20s, they've watched movies like this, like that. They know a little bit now about, oh, the money system is a big scam, right? It's a big Ponzi scheme. But what to do about it? So I've been exploring things that, you know, with people like Howard saying, okay, given the situation, okay, we're debt slaves, you know, we don't have William Wilberforce calling us to, who's going to call us out of slavery, right? As Walter Brueggemann said, can we leave Egypt successfully?
Yeah.
Where? How? And so the best we can do is create awareness amongst ourselves, maybe become each other's bankers by actually lending money to ourselves, maybe through church communities. I said that to Howard's church, Baptist church, years ago. Today we could create our own bank right now. We could lend money to each other without interest. I call interest expectation. We give without expectation because we give to our neighbor who are in financial need now. And you know what? We forgo the expectation of interest that would accumulate in our savings account, but we help our neighbor. And we are rich in cash. We have so much liquidity. Most of it's tied up in speculative finance and stocks. And stocks themselves is a joke. It's not a genuine investment. So let's think about becoming each other's bankers, instituting more peer-to-peer lending programs that work locally. Again, those are things I'm working on. There's too many things to be done, but, you know, again, all of these ideas, all of these practical solutions are right there in front of us.
Do you think the co-ops in terms of credit unions, that was a strong movement for a long time. A lot of them, I know in Cincinnati, are, you know, for companies saving.
Yeah.
You think that, I mean, when you said I can create my own bank, somebody asked on the chat, how can we help support your work? And so one of the answers is, why don't we create our own bank? That sounds like a pretty exciting idea. I didn't know I could do that. I thought I had to be rich to do that.
No, you don't. In fact, I tell people that to create a credit union, it takes almost nothing in terms of cost, maybe a pile of paperwork. To create a charter bank costs about $5 million in Canada to just get the paperwork done. And the interesting thing is once you've created the bank, you can start issuing loans, right? 100 to 1. For every dollar deposit, you can issue $100 of credit, right? And all I need is friends then. And not, it's a secret. It's a mystery of, you know, mystery of banking. It's called fractional reserve banking. Now,
so
I can
start a bank with $1,000.
Yeah,
And I put it in the bank, and then I can start loaning out $10,000 to people?
Yeah. It's a legitimate chartered bank license to create money out of nothing. That's, in fact, they use the word fiat, which means to be created with nothing anyway. So the credit unions, I think, I would say, or public banks like North Dakota has, like, let's, if we're going to play in this game, let's at least support local credit unions. Now, I've argued that local credit unions are playing, unfortunately, the same game as the banks. They're also practicing usury by charging interest on loans and paying interest on deposits. Now, there's only one bank that I know of in the world which is non-Islamic, because under Islam, you're not allowed to charge interest. It makes it very difficult for Muslims to live in our Western banking world. But in Sweden, there's a bank called the JK Bank, which is the only bank approved by Islam, and it's a Western bank which charges no interest on loans and pays no interest in deposits. And I've studied that bank. I've compared it with Van City, the biggest credit union in Canada. And, you know, the Van City guy said, I don't get it, Mark. How do we make money? I said, you don't get it. This bank doesn't need to make money because the benefits are to all the members who won't work for interest. And you're operating it just like any business. You're recovering your costs and by other means, but not by using interest. And so, again, I've had conversation about starting one of these in Edmonton. But a lot of bankers go, I don't get it.
How do I get paid if I'm working in the bank?
The payment is, in the JK Bank, the payment to the people who work in the bank is through, it's called a loan fee. And it's roughly 2% of the value of any loan over a 40-year history of this bank. So they are recovering their operating costs, but it's no different than a lawyer fee, right? It's like, look, you're paying for the services of a financial institution, you're saving interest on the loan, your kid's going to school without interest on their loan. It's a fascinating system. It wasn't designed by economists because it was designed by engineers who understand flow. And that's the interesting thing about money. It has to flow. It can't stagnate. That's when it becomes putrid and we fight about it.
Yeah, this is very, very exciting. You know, it's tell me again the name of the Muslim bank where this is working.
It's not a Muslim bank. It's a Swedish
Western
bank. It's called JAK, YAK, the YAK Members Bank. I've written about it on my website. You can, if you want to read my report.
I'll find it. Thank you.
It stands for Land, Labor, and Capital. That's what JAK stands for.
That's amazing. So the future really is here, isn't it? We just help.
It's within their grasp, right? We're just stuck. We're in a stuck mindset.
Yeah.
So let me pause for a second. We're 36 minutes into it. Maggie, maybe you could put out a call for questions.
Sure. If you would like, if you're calling in, if you've dialed into this call, You can hit *8 on your phone and you'll be put into a queue. We'd love to have your thoughts, your questions, your reflections. Also, keep writing in the chat and we'll respond there. Thanks.
All right. So if you have questions or comments or reflections, can I shift a little bit, Mark? We talked about the accounting instinct you have. I'd like to talk a little bit about the faith community and the spiritual dimension of this. And what does this mean for churches in the faith community? How might they, if they took this seriously, get interested in that?
Well,
I know you're very, you know, it's a ministry is what you're engaged in. Could you just talk about the faith side a little bit in whatever way it occurs to you?
This is the ministry. I'll be up front. I'm raised and I am Roman Catholic. I'll just tell you a little story. I was about to get on a plane to Rome and say to the Pope and the new head of the Vatican Bank, do something courageous, declare internet or international debt jubilee, and resurrect the teachings against usury. And I would invite our Muslim and Jewish brothers to join us in, and probably Buddhists too would understand this, because this is very much part of our Abrahamic teachings. Moses received these teachings from Mount Sinai that you should not charge interest on debt. Right? You should have Jubilee. You should honor Sabbath every 7 years. Debts were to be forgiven. These were the teachings that the Jews had before they went into exile in Babylon in 585. And the question is, did they ever live those teachings after their release from captivity? Every 49 years, wealth was supposed to be redistributed to the 12 tribes. We are now 49 plus 49 years after the 1917 Balfour Declaration. If you look over time, you see patterns of seven. And 2008 was the last seventh period, and we're coming up to the next seven in 2015. And so I'm calling on churches, on leaders to go, okay, so what do we do? And what happened if the Jews forgot the Sabbath, the 7 year? There was something called a Shemitah. Something would happen. Something would befall Israel. And so we have a responsibility to ask what in the tradition of the Creator giving us everything with abundance, like Moses in the desert, how do we live in that reality that everything actually, the truth is abundance, a lie is scarcity, we've made money our God, and how do we come out of Egypt, as Walter's been writing about?
Mm-hmm.
That was the challenge. And I've been advised of the Bernie Madoff victims in New York, and I said, where are your rabbis? Are they teaching Deuteronomy? Are they teaching, are they going back to these ancient economic laws that the Jews had written down that the Catholic Church taught until 1850 about usury and then went silent? So I'm kind of a tough love guy. Like I'm not going to mess around.
you're amazing. Your mind goes where it wants to go.
You have to have a sense of humor, because the thing is, I always say, this is a bad movie. This is a B-movie script that we're living in, and it's completely unnecessary. And God must look upon us and go, you bozos, like, I gave you all of that, and you really messed it up.
Well, I want to put in a pitch here. As you know, Mark, I've written a kind of Kairos document about Jubilee. So if anybody's on the call, let us know one way or another, and I'll send it to you and get your reactions to it. I think there's something very important about the debt and the relationship we have with it, and the fact the Jubilee idea has such a long, amazing history. For that story to have lasted so long, to me, the Old Testament is stories that have endured the test of time, and that fact alone means you got to pay attention to them.
You know, it's so amazing.
But, Maggie, somebody have a question?
Yes, actually, we do have a caller. Can I invite that person in?
Sure.
Hello, Southwest Ohio.
Hi, this is David Rosenberg speaking. You were talking about this program to help people out in the debt-ridden economy. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine, Ellen Beerhorst, the other day, and we came up with this sort of less ambitious program, but it seemed like it was really doable, where we would encourage people that had capital to relieve those that are in debt, especially credit card debt, and in many cases, just by doing that, and still charging interest, and this type of investor could maybe do almost as well as they would on the market. Plus, they'd be really making a systemic change. Also, some of the margin between the credit card interest rate and the loan or gift rate, if someone's willing to do that, could go to nonprofit organizations to help fund them.
That's great.
That's fantastic.
Comment, Mark.
Oh, David, that's exactly what I'm talking about. The interim. I mean, I'm talking idealistic in some ways. But what you're talking about is very pragmatic, and I'm thinking, if my neighbor is paying 24% on their MasterCard, and we were within our community saying, well, why don't we help restructure some of that debt, and I'll buy it off for 7%. I mean, I think there's a win-win. I mean, I'm better off. I'm doing much better than I would in my guaranteed investment certificates. You're better off. You're not paying the 24%, and I think that's a step change in the right direction. So now we become, in a sense, we're becoming each other's bankers. So absolutely agree.
Well,
thank you, David.
I think Peter should help us start a bank.
I'm up for it. I'm going to. I may cut this call short just to start a bank as soon as possible.
Yeah.
All right, well, I got my nickel to put in.
Thank you. Thanks, David.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. Mark, this is John.
Hey, John.
As we're getting here toward the end, I think that for lay people, this is still a fairly complex topic. And I'm wondering if you could suggest two books that would, for a layperson, clarify the kinds of issues and alternatives and possibilities that you see. That is, help us after we leave you to know what we might read.
Well, I'm just saying right now I would say, I know it sounds self-serving, but my book, which is now 7 years old, and I'm writing the next one called, right now it's just called The Economy of Well-Being. And so the first book was, it contains enough, it's still relevant and popular enough. I described it as a roadmap for this new economy. Now, people have said, but Mark, as you're just asking, what are the practical steps? Can you write a handbook on what to do next? And I think the truth is, okay, even if my book lays out a framework, a roadmap, has some examples, you know, the reality is everything beyond this is practice. So, you know, it's action, right? And so what you're doing and what we're all doing is action. So I think the best we can do is pay attention to, not necessarily read a book, but pay attention to where are those positive innovations happening around in our community. And they're happening everywhere, you know that. And how do we learn from those? How do we learn from those communities? Can we share experiences? Can we go to those communities, learn best practices, bring them back to our communities? I think that's what this new economy, I think, is about. It's about sharing those stories, you know, I was told, you write a book for yourself. You write a book because it's your voice. And it really doesn't matter if you can sell one copy. You've just written what you think. And I wrote what I thought, what I think is possible. The next book is a bit of a social fiction. I'm saying, what happens days before, September 2015? What's possible? Right? And so I want to provoke people. It's going to be a little prophetic, a little bit using Jesus's parables maybe. But then that within a few pages go into, so what's practical? What can we do on Monday? And that's my challenge anyway. What are we going to do on Monday? That's slightly different. We don't have to reinvent, the stuff we talked about now is big. There's no question. People go, wow, that's overwhelming. But I can do one little thing on Monday.
Yes.
Mark, one more and then we'll kind of wind down, but unless there's another call. But, we're waiting for, the movement is underway. And so what you just said, that the examples, if we're serious about looking for examples of an alternative way of, whether it's banking or retail or food or debt forgiveness, we can find them. What's the spark? Do we need a really famous person to get out there and start? What does it take so this movement gets covered? It feels like an unreported movement. What's your thoughts about what would light a spark or make this really catch fire? Look at how Ferguson caught fire in a very short time. So now there's all kinds of energy around that. The 2008 crisis, is there any positive way you think that something catches fire on this? Do we need an ad campaign?
Mark?
Looks like Mark may have caught fire. You there, Mark?
You with us? Well, this may be a time to sign off, Peter.
this is how God speaks. So if we can't get Mark back, John, any reflections? Or how about Cormac? Cormac Russell is a friend of John and mine who's with John. Any thoughts?
Thanks, Peter. I guess the question that I'm left with is, are we talking about systems reform or are we talking about community alternatives?
Hello?
Hi, hello? Peter. Can you hear me?
Mark.
I can hear you.
We have
Mark
back.
Good.
Sorry, you know what happened? Mark, guys dropped me.
I know. So our friend Cormac has got a reflection or something. Go ahead, Cormac.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Mark. I guess I was just thinking about that question of how we focus our minds and sometimes the distraction of talking about changing systems, whether it's how they account, how they put value on things, or just how they behave, draws us away from what I think is powerful and what Mark is saying, which is there are actually much more valuable and much more valid community alternatives to how we connect and how we put value and exchange what matters to us. And I guess I was just wondering about that piece. Is there a way of really de-emphasizing the systems reform, which gets people pretty cluttered and confused and really helps people to understand that before we have an alternative bank, we need to create an alternative community culture? Because I think even if we change the accounting system, if we still have a culture of competition, it almost inevitably is that whatever system we replace the existing competitive system with will default back. So it feels to me like a big piece of work exists around changing from a culture of competitiveness to a culture of cooperation. And I just love what Mark, for what I hear him saying, what he's saying is that our ecology belongs to nobody and its fruits belong to everybody. And I think the best place to make sense of that is in our communities. So thank you, Mark.
Hear, hear. I remind my business students the word competition means to strive together from the Latin. So you're absolutely right. I think we absolutely need to address our relationship with money, because I think it often, it's the default. People go, well, what am I going to do? How am I going to pay the bills? And so how are we going to build a new relationship with each other, with our neighbors, deal with the money issues, seriously with the education I'm, the knowledge I'm sharing, and then truly figure out ways of striving together.
Did you, when you, we lost you for a minute, Mark, and I was asking about where the spark will come to make this part of a large national conversation. When a disaster happens, it immediately becomes, part of the national narrative, the larger narrative. But what will it take to take this movement? I know it's underway, but it's underreported, underacknowledged. Any thoughts you have about what would spark something other than a total financial meltdown?
I think Hazel Henderson said it best, the fast track to sustainability has collapsed. And sadly, I have to say that I don't think, I would say, hello, Houston, is anyone still there? You know, is anyone wise in Washington that has the courage to do what we're talking about? And we, change is happening. It's maybe not happening at those levels. We've got, kabuki theater politics and worse. So sadly, I'd have to say that the wake-up call may come about because as a result of collapse. Now, what I'm arguing is, really, do we have to wait for this crisis to be upon us again? I mean, 2008 was a wake-up call. We did nothing. It's just gotten worse, right, the debt situation. And so I don't know if there's a – I don't think there's a soft path. I think, maybe it's the mysteries of our own redemption that we're facing here. But the point is I want to build – I was sitting with the Onondaga, Chief Thorne Lyons, in the spring, Onondaga people of upstate New York, the Iroquois. And they're the ones who signed the two Wampum Belt Treaty with George Washington. And Orrin Lyons, 84-year-old chief, said, and the spiritual Onondaga, Orrin. And he said, the two wampum is a significant symbol of our relationship with the settlers. But what we're in right now, I believe, and I said this to Orrin, is he's one of the few men who understands the money system. Is to create literally a parallel operating system, knowing that this Titanic that we're on right now has already hit the iceberg. It's already sinking. So can we build a more compelling operating system actually by going back to the traditions of the First Nations of Turtle? This is called Turtle Island that we're on, right? And that's who I'm working with now is First Nations people because they're the ones who actually may lead us out of this wilderness. Because they still remember, they still say, thank you, Creator, for everything. Everything was created in abundance. That's why we had the potlatch. That's why we use seashells for money, not paper or coin. And we sewed wampum belts. And, George Washington used to make his own wampum belts for fun at night with Martha. And I said, what? And you imagine these wampum belts represent a pile of gold and are sitting right there in the longhouse in Onondaga. And so we have an incredible opportunity to work with First Nations to help us understand how to get through this. So I do think about that other wampum, that peril, and Orrin, they have a vision. It's not a parallel wampum belt. It's a circle. It's a circle wampum. So, we need to think about the circle. How do we, right? Because money is not GDP or all exponential, right? Curves. Every curve we're looking at is going parabolic exponential. But we need to think about circle.
Yes, that's wonderful. So I think we're near the end of our hour. Mark, any final thoughts you have or any thoughts about the experience of being in this conversation with us?
It brings me great joy and I feel so blessed to be friends with both of you and you're my mentors and inspiration. And so I just feel blessed. I feel joyful. Thank you.
Wonderful. And we're bound together by friendship.
Excellent.
Not contract. Yeah.
And by the way, we have to have a sense of humor. That's what First Nations people teach me.
Yeah.
We really have to have a good sense of humor because I'm sure God does.
Anyway, thank you so much, Mark. If John and I are your mentors, then we've done a hell of a good job. We can retire now, John.
Better than about either of us, right?
All right, thank you so much. Maggie, you want to take it out?
Yeah, I'd like one logistics thing before we sign off. There was a question in the chat, Mark. Is there a link to the well-being measurement tool that you've talked about?
You can go to my website, anielski.com, A-N-I-E-L-S-K-I. And if anyone wants to email me, they can do so, mark@anielski.com. I'm happy to send them any information they're looking for. If they can't otherwise, find them on my site.
Great, great. Thank you for that. And,
okay.
And thank you for being with us here today. It's always helpful to know there are other possibilities, and you're helping us to see that. At this point, we'll just be signing off. Mark's website, as he mentioned, is anielski.com. He's also got www.genuinewealthinc.com.
Yeah.
And we'll hope you all join us again next time. After this call, we're having a meeting to talk about the schedule for next year, so stay tuned about what we come up with. And until then, visit our website, www.abundantcommunity.com, and stay in touch with us. Leslie had posted Peter's email address if you'd like the document that he referred to. It's pbi@att.net. And, of course, Mark gave us his email if you have other questions for him. So this brings our program to a close, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.